Okay, so today's the first class of this new year, 5770. Oh, I forgot to change the date. 5774. And it's Cheshvan. There's an H in there. So you'll have to do your own editing. Put the H after the S in the month of Cheshvan. Mm-hmm. And this 5774.
Okay. You got part of it right.
Yeah, I did. But, yeah. Oh, well. Anyway, and so we will be having class on Wednesday. So I just want to start by just reading a little bit about Chacham Ovadia Yosef, Alav HaShalom, who just passed away. He's 93 years old. And he was the Rishon Lezion, that was his title, Rishon Lezion, the first of Zion. He was the Sephardic chief rabbi and the Sephardic, the greatest Sephardic sage on the planet until this morning. His funeral's right now. So because he is such a gadol, he was such a gadol, such a great rabbi, even though maybe some of us in this room haven't heard of him because he's Sephardic, but he is one of the lights of the Jews, and one of the lights, when it's extinguished, it's important for us to all connect in a little bit. So I'll just read you part of it. It's nice that Arutz Sheva, if anybody wants to see Israel National News, if you want to read the whole thing, but it's nice that they wrote, I'm sure they had this prepared before because everybody else just sent out quick announcements, but they have a very long article about him. But I'll just read you the beginning. Cries of mourning could be heard from the halls outside the hospital room in Jerusalem where Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, 93, returned his soul to his maker on Monday, the 3rd of Cheshvan at 1:30 p.m. So that's just a few hours ago because they're 9 hours ahead.
Right.
Maran, which means our rabbi and mentor, as he was called reverently by his followers, was the chief Sephardic rabbi, the Rishon Lezion of Israel from 1973 to 1983, a world-recognized Talmudic scholar with a photographic memory, foremost halachic authority and master orator. He served as the spiritual leader of the Shas party, political party, since the party's founding in 1982. He was referred to as the Posek Hador, the Torah arbiter of the present generation, Gadol Hador, the greatest one of the generation, and the Maor Yisrael, the light of Israel. Rabbi Yosef's halachic responsa are highly regarded within the Orthodox circles and are considered binding in Mizrahi communities, those communities hailing from the Middle East, Northern Africa, and the Mediterranean, among whom he was regarded as the most important living halachic authority. He was born in Baghdad, Iraq, the day after Yom Kippur in 1920. At the age of 4, during the period of the British Mandate in the land of Israel, he immigrated to Jerusalem with his family. As a teenager, he studied at the Poret Yosef Yeshiva, under its head Rabbi Ezra Atiya. At 24, he married Margalit, the daughter of Rabbi Avram Fatal. The family's 11 children are Talmudic scholars who serve as yeshiva heads and municipal rabbis. I'm going to skip a little bit if I can. In 1947, Rabbi Yosef was invited to Cairo to teach in the yeshiva there. He also served at the request then of the then Sephardi chief rabbi and was the head of the Cairo Beit Din. He left that position after several years and returned to what was now the State of Israel, because he left before it was a state and came back. I'll just tell you one story. There's lots that could be read and should be read, I'm sure, because he did. Let me see if there's more. But I heard just he did have photographic memory. So I heard one time he went into a bookstore to see a new book. And so he stood in the bookstore and for 20 minutes he looked at the book. And then he put the book back on the shelf and he went and paid for it. And they said, Chacham, don't you want to take the book? He said, no. He said, I have the book. I have no space on my shelf.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm paying for it. So, isn't that interesting?
How?
So he really did have a photographic memory. All he had to do was turn the pages and it belonged to him.
So those minds are pretty. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, so he really was a light of Israel. And he made his rulings, many, you know, some of which are controversial, of course, anybody would. I know one of them for the Sephardim is for Sephardic women, he ruled against wearing wigs, that they should wear hats and scarves and not wigs. So there are many Sephardic women who do not wear a wig when they cover their hair. That's not the Ashkenazic ruling, but for many Sephardim, that is. There are many Sephardim who don't hold that way, just because I think it's difficult. But that was the Sephardic ruling. Okay, so let's transition to this. His memory should be for a blessing, and we should all be hopefully enlivened by his Torah. So I wasn't sure who was going to come today, and I wanted to start with some kind of introduction, because really what we're up to in the book is slavery. And I didn't feel that was the right one to start with. for the year. So I'm going to start on a little bit lighter note and a little bit differently. So it's good that Ellie's not here, so I can test you, because I know she knows this answer.
Uh-oh.
So I just wanted to go with a little bit of review of the Sefer Chinuch altogether. So the Sefer Chinuch is a book of the 613 mitzvot, organized by Parsha. And it's interesting just to read the author's introduction. He wants to make it clear that this is not... He's very humble, and he wants to make it clear that this is not his own thought. Like, he doesn't know enough to have written this. It's so interesting that he writes that. So he says, like, anybody would think that somebody who wrote a work like this knows, you know, all of the Gemara and knows all of the Medrash and all the Tosefta and the Jerusalem, you know, Talmud. Yeah, I'm going to close this. Because in order to codify all the mitzvot like this, one would have to have all that knowledge. So he says he doesn't want anybody to think that he has all that knowledge. He's just going by the guiding lights, the Ramban, and Rabbi Isaac Alfasi. He's read their works and reorganized it. So he doesn't want you to think he's as big a scholar as he might look. So I think that's nice that he says that. So that's where he got it from. Again, he writes this for his bar mitzvah aged son. That was the point of this book. So, and it's just interesting to reread what he says. Perhaps as a result of organizing this according to the Parshiyot and making it accessible, the young will become more interested in them, giving their attention to them on Sabbath and festival days, and will turn back from going wild in the streets of the cities to be enlightened by the light of the eternal life.
So that's always been a problem.
Yeah. The youngsters, he's hoping that the youngsters of tender age will ask one another, how many are the mitzvot in this week's parasha? And that should lead everyone to wise thought. That should be a matter of, you know, of pursuit of Torah trivia. And they should be able to find the answers here. So that being said, that if the Torah is a book of mitzvahs, which it is, so you'd think that it would start with mitzvahs. But we know that this book of Bereishit that we're in right now has very few. In fact, only three. So, today's trivia question and test. What are the three mitzvahs in Sefer Bereishit?
Does it count if I just looked?
First try to think and then look.
To be fruitful and multiply.
Sounds good.
Since you separated the light from the day, would it have anything to do with Rosh Chodesh? Celebrating?
That's a good question, but no.
That came later. Exodus.
Yeah, that's right. Right. That's right.
Okay.
I know there's very few, so I'll try to give you some hints. So just to hear out the stories, okay, so there's creation, Adam and Eve, so that's where you get proof or remove from all
something from the Noah.
Then you have
story.
Noah, so mm-hmm. that's interesting, because we'll see if there's anything from Noah, but it doesn't seem like it. Mm-hmm. Then you have Abraham and his story, what he... Yes, okay. Circumcision is the second one for Samila. Mm. And then you have Isaac and the binding, and you have Jacob and the tribes and him leading his family out of Lavan's house and struggling with the angel and giving lots of hints. And shortly after that, we get the third mitzvah, and then...
Like I said, I looked, so I should answer, so...
The third mitzvah...
Oh, so you know.
Entire book? Okay, so you could say...
The sinew, not...
They're right, not to eat the Gid Hanasha.
Oh, okay.
Those are the three mitzvahs in the book. So, and that's all we have for the whole Sefer Bereishit. But we're in this week's parasha of Lech Lecha, where the mitzvah of Bris Milah appears. So I want to look at that a little bit. But I just want to also ask, so we'll talk about these three mitzvahs for a minute, but I also want to ask, how do we know it's a mitzvah? So I don't fully know the answer. I'm going to rely on the author here, who says he didn't actually even know, because there's a lot of times when there's a commandment, and how do you know? Like, Lech Lecha, that's a commandment. Right. Go! Right?
So why is
so
that?
So to whom does that apply? Is that a mitzvah, or is it only one hash? But there's other thing. Other, like, how do we know that every single person should be circumcised? You know,
it's a mitzvah as opposed to
Abraham, right? Although it does say here, right, this is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after. That's pretty clear. Every male among you shall be circumcised. Okay, so that's a mitzvah for the generations, for the children of Abraham, right? So that's very clear. Which is why the Muslims circumcise also. Because they are the children of Abraham, so they're included in this covenant, and they circumcise for covenantal reasons. So Yeah.
It's very interesting. No, continue. Uh-huh.
So they get a spiritual merit for that circumcision. And apparently, and I don't know the source of this, but I learned it from Robinson Leacone of the Jewish Renaissance Center, there is a connection between circumcision and possession of the land.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a spiritual connection between those two. So since the Muslims circumcise for covenant reasons, they have a merit in the land. There's something that's there. However, our circumcision, and this is a fascinating piece just to think about the spiritual roots of this. Even though there's a lot more Muslims doing a lot more circumcising, so like the number of covenantal circumcisions in the Muslim people is greater than Jews, we have three steps to our circumcision, and they only have two. So we have Mila, Priya, and Mitzitza, right? And they only have Mila and Priya. So Mila is the cutting. Priya is the revealing of the tip, where you pull the skin back. So that's Mila and Priya. And the third step is drawing forth of the blood, which is done traditionally by putting the mouth right on the organ and drawing, sucking to draw the blood forth. Mm-hmm. Can also now be done by a glass pipette. But that is a necessary step, and that's the third step. So it's interesting, we have far fewer covenantal circumcisions because we're a much smaller people, but that third step makes the whole thing into a much more meritorious procedure. So the merit that the Jews generate through circumcision and the merit that the Muslims are generating through circumcision is they are...
It's the argument anyway.
Right. I mean, from a spiritual perspective, they are in struggle with each other. Right now, the Muslims have enough merit to still have a piece of ownership in the land. When that will be used up, and there's an idea that it will be used up, that merit will run out, then our merit, even though we're fewer people and have done fewer circumcisions, but because we do it in this three-step way, it will kick in and the land will belong to us alone. So that's a concept. So, but what's interesting, just to think about, if you're just thinking about from the spiritual, skip politics and all that stuff, right? But just from the spiritual root, what is under siege right now in the Jewish world, besides circumcision altogether, right? And they have this whole movement called the MGM movement, right? Male genital mutilation, and people are against that. Mm-hmm. Or the intactivists that are against circumcision altogether. So circumcision altogether is under siege, but particularly, even in those who accept it, the third step. Right, mitzitza. There's a problem.
Bleeding doesn't come from the cutting.
Right?
Bleeding doesn't come.
I think some bleeding does, but I think there is an idea to draw forth extra blood for whatever spiritual reason there is that it's required. But I think also possibly for wound care. However, it turns out mouths are a lot dirtier than pretty much any other place on our body.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that could be introducing things, which it sometimes does, as we know. I think Mrs. Pollock's grandson. I know Mrs. Pollock's grandson passed away.
Really?
Yeah, from mitzitza-induced illness.
One of our grandsons had a severe bleeding problem. I mean, didn't have a blood disorder, but started hemorrhaging in the night afterwards.
Wow.
And had to be taken to the hospital.
Wow, that's scary. Right.
How did they prove that?
I think it was the herpes infection that was transferred by a particular mole who was known to have transferred it to a few children. Unfortunately. Yeah, and I forgot who told me, but she said that death was harder for her than any of the deaths. She's a Holocaust survivor, so that was harder for her than any of the other deaths in her life. So unfortunately, that can happen. But in general, it's been something that's been protective throughout the generations. The way that we've done, if you think about doing circumcisions from time immemorial,
you don't really hear very much about.
You do not hear very much about problems at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a procedure that's been done in all kinds of places throughout the ages without sterile fields.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much worked.
The wine.
You didn't have wine. Wine isn't, you know, I mean, it could be. I mean, they do rinse their mouths with wine first, whatever that does, you know. But it
isn't. Well, didn't they used to dip the instruments in the wine, too?
Maybe.
I don't know.
That would be something interesting to ask.
I have that in mind.
Jay Fetter
may
or,
not be true.
Or Sener, Shelley Sener. Just to ask. But, yeah. But, and they didn't, of course, they didn't have scalpels. They often used. So it's interesting.
They didn't have cigar cutters.
Flint rock.
Right, so they say flint rock, and that sounds like so terrible, but if you ever see the obsidian rocks, you know, they are so sharp.
Mm-hmm.
So sharp. You just touch it and you're cut. Yeah.
like a newly sharpened knife.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. So they did have sharp rocks that did cuts that you could manage. Anyway, so that's circumcision, and it is about, the whole point of the mitzvah is about correcting the body physically in our own hands to know that we're born into this world imperfect, and it's in our hands and our requirement to fix the body that's born not finished, and we have to finish it. And so, too, from the physical, we should learn to the spiritual, that we're born spiritually and finished, and it's in our hands, so to speak, to correct ourselves spiritually, and that's our directive. And it's put specifically on that organ that so easily leads astray, and also is the connector of generation to generation. So it's through that the generations are passed, but also from that one could be led astray. So it's in that the covenant is made to say, there's a job here, and you need to fix yourself and fix the generations.
You need to be part of it. It's right. Human behavior.
Right. And then there's two pieces of the mitzvah. We say for Bris Milah, there's two Asher Kedeshanu B'mitzvotav brachas, which is very rare to have two mitzvah brachas for one mitzvah. So there's a question, maybe it's actually two mitzvahs, and it seems like that's the answer. So the first one is on the cutting, al hamilah, right? And the second one is lahachnis labris, right? To bring your child into the covenant, which is what milah does, but that's just the beginning. It's a whole life's process to bring your child into the covenant, really. Mm-hmm. So that's just the initiation of the process, knowing that it's a process. So there's really two separate things. One is the actual cutting, making the sign, and the other is initiating the process of bringing your child into the covenant. Right, and that mitzvah applies to men, meaning women are not required to circumcise their sons, and they're not held liable for not circumcising their sons. We do hear stories of women who went out of their way to do that, to keep that mitzvah and to circumcise them. And we have the custom to circumcise newborns that don't make it, even to 8 days, and that we return them circumcised. So even...
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh. I didn't know that. So yeah. if a newborn dies before... I mean, I know if there's a problem, they wait longer than 8
right.
days until the
right.
child is healthy.
Right.
Or healthy enough. Right. But... So if a child dies prior to 8 days, they circumcise them before burial.
Wow.
Really? I didn't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I find interesting. You know, just I don't know all the stuff about that. There's all kinds of burial things that are... Yeah, I don't know all the reasons for it.
Yeah.
Shouldn't need to know from it.
I was going to say.
Shouldn't need to know from it. And anyway, that is our custom, that we do that. What else was I going to say about that? Yeah. Yeah, so, right, so a boy who's not circumcised by his parents for whatever reason, once he becomes bar mitzvah in a day, it becomes his mitzvah.
Can he be bar mitzvah without being circumcised?
Yeah.
Apparently so.
Yeah, he can be bar
mitzvah.
Well, so bar mitzvah, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as being bar mitzvah. Becoming bar mitzvah means you turn 13.
There's no
ceremony,
so it's just
no
a question
nothing.
Of the obligation devolves right. upon a... child when they are no longer a child.
Yes, that's right. Right. So there's no such thing. I mean, I hear it's very interesting. You hear people will say, you know, I was never bar mitzvah, and they say that like sadly, like they never achieved maturity, right? Or you'll hear people say I was fully bar mitzvah. You know, fully bar. But that is a common expression too. Also. So there's no such thing as being bar mitzvah. We
so
make
it's
a
just
party
a passage of time.
To celebrate the fact. All you have to do is live until your birthday. That's it.
And then you
That's
are.
The whole thing. Now, as any parent knows, it's a huge celebration to get a kid to live, to be that age. You know, with all the things that come in the way, all the times they fall, and all the stupid things they do, and all the running into the street, and all the sass that they give you, whatever it is, that they made it, and you didn't
and you
kill them
it.
Until age 12 or 13. It's like, it's huge. So so that you, of course, want to make a party to celebrate that they made it to that age, and you usually celebrate it with a mitzvah that
so
they
the
hadn't
process,
been able to do before.
The ceremony and the being called to the Torah,
all of that,
all
is,
of
right.
that is just all purely rabbinic.
It's not even rabbinic.
It's not even rabbinic.
Purely,
purely
community custom.
Really?
Purely, 100%.
The being called the Torah is...
It's just the first time that you can. There's no requirement at all. If you weren't called to the Torah, it's nothing. And in some communities, they don't. In the Shar Yashiv community, they do call them to the Torah for a bracha, but they don't allow them to lane. That way, there's just a blanket ruling, no laning, you get an aliyah, and that's it.
Shar Yashiv
is Rabbi Freifeld's yeshiva, now Rabbi Yeager's yeshiva. But that's their custom there because they don't want to put that pressure on the boys. This is not about pressure. It's not about a performance. You want to lane Geikas into Hayden another time.
Which it is.
Right,
right.
So they
become such
so by making a rule. Right. So by making a rule that you are not permitted in that community, there is no laning on a bar mitzvah. You get an aliyah, you make a bracha, you and everybody says mazel tov, and you sit down. That's it. And then you
not
have.
Much
I mean,
smarter is that.
And back in the day, you know, back before people had the money that we have today. It was kechel and herring. That was it.
Right. Well, you just had a slightly nicer kiddush. That was
right. That was it. Or not.
Yeah.
That's it. It was kechel and herring was the slightly nicer kiddush.
That's what I'm saying.
Otherwise, it was kechel.
That's what I'm saying.
The herring made it nice.
Right.
So
what if you're a convert? Because when I was 13, I wasn't a Jew.
Right. Doesn't matter. No such thing. When you convert, you're fully required to keep all the mitzvahs. As soon as you come out of the mikvah,
but
you're
never
a bar mitzvah.
Oh, okay. I was like, when
bar and bat mitzvah just means you are the son of or the daughter of. You're obligated in the commandments.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with age. So if you're a convert at 55, you're a bar mitzvah when you come out of the mikvah. You're now required to do everything. You weren't required when you went in.
Right.
You are when you come out. So that's it. Right. Okay. So now you're required. So that the idea of just marking that date for the 12 and 13-year-old is we're marking the time that you're required in the commandments.
Okay.
It's interesting that we don't mark age 20. And converts don't get this grace period. Well, Hashem knows them, so Hashem gives grace to whoever Hashem needs to give grace to. But there's an official grace period between bar mitzvah and age 20. So, or bat mitzvah and age 20. So from bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, a Jew is chayev, is obligated in all mitzvot between people. So they can be taken as a full adult to any Beit Din for stealing, for whatever it is, for owning an ox that gores, whatever it is that's between people. However, between man and God, between, you know, with the divine relationship, you're not fully punishable, let's say, for sleeping through davening at age 17 when teenage boys
sleep all the time
and just have such a hard time dragging themselves out of bed or whatever it is. So God cuts you slack until age 20 when you're old enough to be held responsible for those mitzvahs. So he recognizes a difference between behaving as an adult within the community of human beings and behaving as an adult within the divine relationship. So not that you're not required to keep those mitzvahs, you are. You just get a little more slack. So age 20 is called Bar Onshin, the age of punishment. Right, so age 13 is Bar Mitzvah. Age 20 is Bar Onshin.
That's why we don't celebrate it.
Right, but it is something that people mark often individually with extra prayer or whatever, just to realize they have entered a new phase where the yoke is heavier. The consequences are heavier.
I just wanted to say something when we were talking about who decides which becomes a mitzvah for everybody. I was just recently reading something in the Encyclopedia Judaica, and I came up with just saw this term that I've never heard before, hermeneutics. Do you know this word?
Hermeneutics.
Spell it.
Is it H-E-R-M-E and then N-U, I think, E, hermeneutics.
Okay.
So this is, and the definition was the science of biblical interpretation.
Signs
of biblical interpretation. So there are a number of principles on how they can be applied to certain verses in the Torah. For example, everybody knows if this is so, then how much more so that would be.
Okay, all right. So it's like principles of logic.
Exactly.
Designed.
It's principles of interpretation of biblical.
But it's a science. It's called a science.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of.
Yeah.
I guess,
right. So I don't know that, but that is the English word. That's hermeneutics is sort of like phylacteries, meaning it's an English word.
It doesn't have any.
That has no translate. Like, what are you going to do with that word? It just means that one thing.
Right.
So you might as well say tefillin, because nobody knows what phylacteries are. They're tefillin, right?
Right.
So hermeneutics is the 13 principles through which the Torah is interpreted.
Yeah.
How you interpret Torah verses. Yeah, but it doesn't. I don't know if it has another But I'm pretty sure it's just like phylacteries. Like it just
I've never heard this word. Yeah. And I started reading, but it's you know, it's right. pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
All this principle, I can't even reproduce them now. It's just way too deep and complicated.
Right. Right. So there are rules. That's why I mean, it, and it drives me nuts. I happen to be related to some people who do this, but the, I mean, whatever's on YouTube and that kind of thing, the biblical interpretation in the hands of Christians doesn't use it, and in the hands of heretics doesn't use it. And even today's heretics are mostly Christian-based. So that's what I was going to say. There are, there were in the past Talmidim Chachamim who were heretics, and then they could really, they could do
some... Because they had so much knowledge.
They had so much knowledge that they could really take biblical verse and try to understand it. But today... people are looking at things and saying, like, they'll take the verse and they'll read it and say, it says clearly in the text, right?
Whatever.
Stone the non-virgin bride.
So
that's what it says clearly. So that's what it means. When, if you will just look a this much into our oral interpretation, it doesn't mean that at all, right? But they take this straight up, they want the straight up, straight through, and like, what? Why didn't God write it differently if he meant it differently? Well, it's because we actually have 13 principles through which the Torah is interpreted, and it means many different things, and you can't read it straight up. You just can't. There's no such thing as reading the Torah text straight up and getting what you're supposed to get out of it. It just doesn't exist. So so people who do that are usually people who aren't aware of those principles.
Right.
So even if they're very faith-based and really trust in God and his Torah that he gave us, Christians, for instance.
And of course you have to know the oral Torah.
Right. Exactly. So that's what I'm saying.
So
you can't possibly interpret any of this stuff without a lot of background. So so just disregard anything that you might see on YouTube that's against anything, especially anything about, it's, you know, there's so much anti-Torah stuff now. And slavery is one of those areas. That's why I really want to do more study. I was really hoping this whole summer to spend, like, really understanding it, which I did not get to. But
I had a few things in
here. Yeah, I did. But it's a whole big thing, and yes. Yeah,
so these hermeneutics. So if you're in yeshiva and you're studying Torah every day, is this something that's ingrained in you?
Yes.
That there is these 13 steps that you should go through each day when you're
Not each day. No, it's not each day.
To interpret the...
Yeah, it's sort of like going to law school. Once you go to law school, and I can't even... I can't even do the proper... She's the attorney.
Right,
the
right.
But once you go... Once you've learned enough about the world...
Okay.
...that you can now go to law school and understand those courses, because, of course, a six-year-old can't.
Right.
Right? So it's not like you just start. You have to know enough before you can start that study. Mm-hmm. Once you've started that study, then they do teach you how to think differently, how to analyze differently, how to look at things from a different perspective so that you can understand what's going on and how to ask a question that other people aren't asking. So that's what it's taught. And it's taught in the later stages. So you're not learning that in sixth grade.
Yeah, okay.
You're not. But you might learn a little piece in sixth grade. You might learn what a Kal Vachomer is. But it's not going to be until you're in, I don't know, Beis Medrash, or certainly in, at least later in high school before you learn how to apply that on a regular basis and where it is. But you'll learn the concept, and then they'll say, oh, this is a Kal Vachomer that shows you that, you know, whatever. And so, but slowly, you're going to start to hear these concepts, and you'll get a solid basis for them so that hopefully somebody who's been studying for a while, a man usually, who's been studying for his whole life until age 21, and he's relatively smart, he should be able to sit down and list these off at that age. But not 12.
And probably they become just ingrained.
Yeah.
And so that when something is... So if they look at a thing, they just automatically apply those principles to the interpretation.
Right.
So they don't even have to go, you know, consciously through the steps.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And it's not 13 steps, it's 13 different ways.
Okay.
Which might each one have its own steps. So, yeah. So, yeah, there's so much to learn, which is exactly why this author says, don't think, I mean, I just love how he phrases it, what he says, let's see that, let's read you that. Perhaps a person who studies this work will think its author gathered all its laws by his toil and the fine quality of his study in the words of the Talmudic sages, the Tanaim and the Amoraim. Were that the case, the author would have to be well-versed in every corner of the Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmud, Medrash Sifra and Sifri and the Tosefta. Hence, as he knows himself and what wisdom there is in him, it is seemly to let the truth be known that whoever hears this voice, that I didn't do this. Meaning, in order to know what's in this, you do have to know the whole Babylonian Talmud, and the Jerusalem Talmud, and the Medrash Sifra, and the Midrash Sifra, and the Tosefta. If you know that, you can write this.
And to remember.
Yeah. Right, you have to know that and hold it.
You know,
that's why somebody like Chacham Ovadia Yosef, that just passed away, Alav HaShalom, that's why he's so valuable, because there is very few people that hold that kind of knowledge in one head. You know, I mean, think about science today, or PhDs today, as opposed to PhDs of the last century, and really by last century, I mean really the 1800s, early 1900s. At that time, to become a PhD, you had to contribute original research to the field, which meant you had to know the field and then add to it. Nobody today knows the field of physics. There's not such a person as can hold all of physics in their head. Right? They work with different people so that they can contribute something, but no, you have to specialize in something smaller. Right? So we have very few people that have that kind of breadth of knowledge that they can really pull from so many different areas and see things on the background of so much and evaluate it based on that. We mostly have specialists, right, in one little area, but doesn't mean that they have the breadth underneath that specialty. They just specialized in something, which means they could be completely missing something in something else, right? So you go to a sleep specialist, he'll give you a CPAP. He knows all about CPAPs and how to make them work, but he doesn't ask you about your anxiety. You know, why aren't you sleeping well at night? That's not his question. Just, do you need a CPAP? That's it. Because they specialize in CPAPs, but not in, you have to go to a psychiatrist for the anxiety. Right? And they're not talking to each other. So, right.
Yes.
So that's what I'm saying. So it's very rare in Torah to have somebody that has all that. But we do have some Talmidim Chachamim, the older ones, and very few per generation that really hold that breadth. And that's what's so vital in a generation, is to have some of those people that hold as much as possible in a physical brain of Torah, that they are walking Sifrei Torah, and they hold all of that. So, and the rest of us just have to read what they wrote, you know, or what they wrote from what the others wrote. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So we absorb what we can, but we just have to know that, you know, it's a bracha that we can absorb what we can, and there are people who hold it all. And it's amazing. And even they know they don't hold it all. Anyway, okay, so how do we know it's a mitzvah? We basically, there are lots of directives in the Torah. We have the concept that there's 613. That is straight up Masorah for us. One of the aspects that we know is that one of the things that it writes out, it comes from the Gemara, so the Gemara just tells us what our Masorah is. There's 613. We know that number. How do we get that number? The Gemara would like to put it on something. So one place where they put it is Torah. The gematria for the word Torah is 611. So that's what we got in the Torah, but we have 613. So the first of the two of the ten, not ten commandments, because there's 14 commandments in the ten statements, but the first two statements, we ourselves heard. We didn't need the Torah to give us that, because we were there and we heard it in person. So the 611 of the Torah and the two that we heard in person makes 613, so that's one. And there's a few other mathematical things where they say it comes from this, it comes from that, it comes from the other thing, but we definitely have a clear tradition that there's 613. Mm-hmm. So now the question is, what are they? Right? Because you have to look at the Torah and you might be able to count more or less depending on how you might think when it says, you shall do this. Is that a mitzvah or is that not a mitzvah? Right? So you could make different counts. And we could probably, without a tradition of 613, we probably could have the Rambam counting 640 and the Ramban counting 611.
Probably.
You know, we could have such a thing that they have different ways that they decide it is, but we're clear that it's 613. So they all have to figure out how 613 works for them. So the basic, the Rambam has his 613, the Ramban has his 613. They mostly overlap. There are a couple of differences. This book goes by the Rambam, that he often brings where the Ramban differs, just so that we know the difference. But basically, we're relying on that. And then, with Bris Milah, which I read this, but it doesn't make sense, but I'll say it anyway because I liked it, and then I realized it doesn't make sense. But said that Noah got the seven mitzvot, the seven Noahide mitzvahs, and the eighth mitzvah is Bris Milah, which is nice because he's on the eighth day, right? Mm. And then I realized, wait, a second Pur Ravu comes before, and that's not one of the seven Noahide mitzvahs.
Right.
So really, it's the ninth one. But but I did read that in an article on, I don't know, what was it? YU Torah, or something like that. OU Torah, one of those sites that I read. But meanwhile, and since there's not as many of us as I thought there might be.
But also interesting, as an example, the commandment not to steal, it means, so how is it interpreted that it really means not to kidnap?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. That's for the Jews.
Because only for the Jews.
And for the non-Jews, I believe. So we're going to look just for a minute here at the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the seven Noahide commandments. Let me just remind you of the Gid Hanasha, since we do have a number three in a little space there. I'll just back up for 1 second. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to remind you of that mitzvah, which is in next week's parsha, I think. Right, it's not this week. This week has the Prismila, next week has Gid Hanasha. So not eating that sciatic nerve. We looked at the Rav Hirsch one time, and I'll just remind you, because I liked it so much, that Rav Hirsch says, it does say we keep this commandment until this very day, that we don't eat that sciatic nerve because of the battle with the angel and Jacob, right? So Rav Hirsch says, really? There's a battle between one angel and one very important guy in our history, but because of that, all of us don't eat the Gid Hanasha for all the generations? Could that be? Just to remember the battle? He says, no, it's got to be more than that. And what it is that Jacob was injured in his thigh. And then I love his language. He says he limped forward into history. Right? Because he's before history, so he has to go into it. We look back and see behind. But he limped into it. So what it says is that the Jew, it's to remind us that the Jew is not stable on his legs. We shouldn't look to our bodies for our source of stability. Our physical prowess is not the measure of our strength. But rather, our hearts and our minds, our intellects and our souls, that's what we offer to the world and that's our strength. So our body carries that, but it's not our body that's the strength, which is why Jacob limps into history, to show that the Jew is not stable on his legs. That's not our strength. We're not men of war. We have to fight every once in a while, but that's not our thing. You know, that's why we don't have Jewish sports heroes, and that's why we, you know, it's just not, we have more owners of sports teams than players in sports teams. So that's the Jewish thing. So so it's really brains. We're about the brains and the intellect and the neshama. We shouldn't either trade neshama for brains, because we do that also in the secular world, thinking that, you know, college education is the top thing. And it's really neshama education is the top thing, and intellectual education should support that, not supplant that. But anyway, that's why we don't eat the sciatic nerve, is to remind us that physical stability is not our thing, it's the intellectual. So now we have these, now let's move into the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach, last week's parasha. So we have these seven things, it's six do's, six don'ts and one do. Right, so the six don'ts are, and I brought you the Rambam about them. Don't commit a Vedazara, don't murder, don't steal, don't eat the limb from a living thing, don't curse God, don't have sexual impropriety, sometimes it says adultery, but it's more than that, and do appoint judges and courts of justice to enforce the six don'ts. So those are the seven commandments that the Torah believes all people are held accountable for. So what are they? So the Rambam has written a book called the Yad HaChazaka, or the Mishnah Torah. It's really called the Mishnah Torah, the repetition of the Torah, is what Mishnah means. So it's the repetition of the Torah. It's all the laws of the Torah organized in a systematic, encyclopedic way. It's in 14 volumes. The volume that this is from is called Shoftim, Sefer Shoftim. 14 in Gematria, in letters, is Yud Dalid, so that's Yad. That's hand. So it's also called, instead of the Mishnah Torah, it's also called the 14 volumes, but in this case it's called the strong hand, the Yad HaChazaka, the strong hand, because it's strong.
Same as Mishnah Torah?
Same as Mishnah Torah. The Yad HaChazaka is the same as the Mishnah Torah because it has 14 volumes, so the Yad is 14, right? So strong hand equals the strong 14 volumes. So those are the two ways that this book is referred to. In the book, Shoftim, there is then each book has a few different chapters in it, and each, they're not really chapters, I think each book has a few different sub-books, let's say, in it, and each one of those is divided into chapters. So this is one of the 14, Sefer Shoftim. Inside that, there's a few different halachas, hilchot of something, And this is the Halachas of Kings, Halachot Melachim. In chapter 9 of Halachot Melachim, it discusses the seven Noahide laws. So that's what I brought here, the translation from this. And I realized after rereading this stuff about how people shouldn't think, you know, the author wrote it, you shouldn't think I translated this. This was from Chabad.org, translated by, oh, just his name just flew out of my mind, the guy who translates it. He has it published in English, but they have permission to print his stuff on Torah.org, and I printed it from there. I didn't translate this. So this is chapter 9 in Sefer Shoftim of Hilchot Malachim. So halacha 1, so it's interesting because we call them halachas. Each one is called a halacha, but they don't always have halacha in them. They're just, but that's how we refer to each paragraph inside these chapters. They're called halachas. Sometimes they're philosophy, sometimes they're information, sometimes they're history, but they're each one called a halacha. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, that's how we divide it up. So halacha 1 is, there are 6 precepts commanded to Adam. Prohibition against the worship of false gods, the prohibition against cursing God, the prohibition against murder, the prohibition against incest and adultery, the prohibition against theft, the command to establish laws and courts of justice. So which one is that missing? That's 6 and there's 7.
Missing the not eating a limb from the living.
Correct. Mm-hmm. When was that commanded?
To Noah.
Excellent. To Noah, when he was allowed to eat meat, because Adam and Eve were vegetarians, right? So Noah got to eat meat after the flood, and that's when he was commanded with not eating the limb of a living animal. So, even though we got them from Moses, they came earlier to Adam, and those are considered, so he has lots of information in here, so they do belong to us too, but they're different for us than they are for non-Jews.
So I have a question about the third one here, prohibition against cursing God. In the Torah, it's the prohibition against taking God's name in vain. It's not the same thing.
No,
right?
It's not the same thing.
So is it, we just take it for granted that we can't curse God?
No, I think that's a separate, it's a separate one of our 613.
Do we have it somewhere else?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's just not,
allowed to curse, right? Okay. Not allowed to curse God. Let's see, does it go into that? Yeah, so let's look in halacha number 3. A Gentile who curses God's name, whether he uses God's unique name or one of his other names in any language, is liable. The law does not apply with regard to Jews. That's all he says. So that's, so I think in, it's interesting because I remember when I was in summer camp, I think at age 12, I said, gee whiz. And somebody who was a strong Christian said, you should not say that. That's taking, that's, you know, taking the Lord's name in vain. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Gee whiz.
Yeah. Because that's, instead of, that's instead of saying,
right.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Something else. Right. So you shouldn't say it. So she didn't like it if people would say geez or gee whiz or anything like that, because that, she felt that was cursing God. Right. So it's, that's a question for the halachic analysts. For a Christian who believes that that person, that that name is the name of God, if they would say something negative, would that, here it says, a Gentile curses God's name, whether he uses God's unique name or one of his other names in any language, is liable. So I just wonder, you know, that, that, what that halacha would be. The laws, one thing I do know is that the 7 Noahide laws are much more stringent and much less forgiving than the 613 mitzvot.
But if that's,
because there's so few of them, you can,
there's very few, and
little.
Christian and Gentiles are judged very harshly in them. There's not the space that there is for Jews in the 613.
Well,
so it's just a different, it's a different calculus.
Yeah.
It is a different calculus. So,
I think the adultery one is the one that bugs me the most, because there were so, after Noah, there were so many times when there were multiple wives.
That's not adultery.
It's not adultery.
No. Because the multiple wife thing came up much, much later as being that you couldn't have multiple wives.
Right.
Yeah, multiple wives is not adultery.
Even that is.
Multiple men is adultery. But multiple women is not. And, or having a relationship with a woman who belongs to another man, that's adultery. So if a man marries 6 women and they're his wives, that is not adultery.
Okay.
If a single man has sex with somebody else's wife,
that is.
That is adultery.
Got it.
Yeah,
or
the man,
a married
woman.
Man.
Or if a married woman.
Okay.
Yeah, if a married man has sex with a single woman, that is
okay.
Not adultery.
If
a married man has sex with somebody else's wife, that's adultery.
Yeah, yeah, she just married, right.
But if a man has relationship with many women, Without marrying them, it's
not adultery. That's not adultery.
As long as they're not otherwise
That's promiscuity.
But they are adulterers by the women.
Without having a relationship, without being married to him?
No.
It's not an adultery either?
No, adultery is having sex with somebody who's married to somebody else.
Okay. So if the man is married to somebody.
So a woman who has multiple...
A woman, let's say a college girl who sleeps with 16 guys in her freshman year. She's promiscuous. She's not adulterous.
Okay.
She's not adulterous. All right.
But if she has relations with her married professor,
that's not adultery.
Adultery. No, because
she is not married. He is married.
Yeah. So
you have to be married.
So the woman has to be married.
The woman's status that determines if it's adultery or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's
it's adultery.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. It's a woman. Mm-hmm. So if the woman is married to somebody,
the woman
is married to a man that's not the one she's having.
I'm so glad.
If the woman is single, it's not adultery.
Okay.
If you and unlike in American thought, which must come from something Christian, but if she conceives out of wedlock, that child, we don't have a status for that child.
Right. There's no
In
status.
English, that's a bastard.
Mm-hmm.
But in Jewish, it's nothing.
It's is almost worse than...
No, it's just not. It's just, no, it's not. It's a child. It's fine. It's whatever it is. It's
but
fine.
But if its mother was Jewish, it's a Jewish child.
Yes, but it's not a bastard.
Right.
Now, we, in Hebrew, in Jewish, we use the word mamzer to mean the same thing that we use bastard for. Meaning, not technically, we use it to mean a not nice person. That he's such a bastard, he's such a mamzer. We say that in Jewish.
But
bastard and mamzer are actually positions, titles of somebody, and they don't mean the same thing. So while they do mean the same thing in terms of cursing somebody or saying something bad about somebody, deprecating somebody, they don't mean the same thing in what they are. A bastard is born out of wedlock.
In English.
A momser is the product of an adulterous or incestuous relationship.
If the woman is not married, the offspring is not a momser.
Yeah,
okay.
And the child can still be.
And the child is fine. That's what I mean by nothing. The child is fine.
There's no bad stigma attached at all.
Right.
I thought that a child born of an unwed mother was always.
That's why I wanted to be very careful. Because we use momser and bastard again. In English,
we Jews use that the same,
but they are not the same.
So, a momser definition?
Momser is the product of an incestuous or adulterous relationship.
So, if a woman is married and then she has
brother,
a child
sister,
from someone else.
Yeah.
But that's why probably we have a matrilineal rule, because women could have children without being married,
correct.
And the child is Jewish.
That's why the whole thing about people like getting a get,
very important,
or somebody who is lost, like in the Twin Towers or whatever, having because of that.
Absolutely,
okay, because those women were.
That's exactly why.
Oh, okay.
Right. So
okay.
right. So right. let's. Okay. It's interesting because the rabbi who comes to town to do the gets, there's an expert that comes to town to do the gets. He said that he's seen a big decline in gets over the last couple of decades, not because there's fewer divorces, but because there are fewer parents pushing their children to get gets. So it was the
even within Orthodox?
Not within Orthodox.
No.
In general, the today's 60-year-old, right, when she got divorced at 30 years ago, her parents... who are now 90,
said, make sure
you get a get. She didn't keep kosher, she didn't keep Shabbos, but she got a get.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah, but today's 30-year-old, whose parents are today 60, is not being pushed by her parents to get a get.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't really understand how vital it is. And so there's not that parental pushing. So today's non-observant Jew... is not worried about a get. So, unfortunately, if that person got married, usually what they do is they trafe up the initial wedding ceremony so she wasn't actually married. She was just living with the guy. That's how they
solved
it. But
then the rabbi wouldn't, when I got married to Duke, the rabbi wouldn't marry me until I produce the get.
Yeah, because your first wedding was a good wedding. That's why. So that's the problem. So what I'm saying is today, a lot of the weddings aren't even good weddings.
I see.
So that's how they fix the problem. Because if the woman gets married, she's married to a Jew, then she gets divorced, but she didn't get a get. And then she marries another Jew or non-Jew, whatever, and she has a kid,
then
that kid's a momser and can never marry another Jew except for a momser.
What is a good marriage? What? A conservative wedding. Is it
Right. That's tough.
That's punishing somebody.
It sounds like it's punishing, but so is taking crack when you're pregnant. It's not about you. It's about what your mom did. Right? If you're born a crack baby, you're born a crack baby. It's because what your mom did. So it's a very serious thing, which is why we push so hard to get a get. So what they do today, how they solve the problem today, is they say, you know, that marriage, it wasn't actually kosher. There weren't kosher witnesses. There wasn't kosher rings. There wasn't kosher reading. It wasn't a kosher wedding. They never were married in the first place. And so, therefore, she didn't need a get, and therefore, this child is not a momser. That's how they fix that today. Mm-hmm. However, you got married by somebody who knew how to do a wedding, and they couldn't trafe it up. Right, so that's why, I mean, they didn't have to in your case because you got to get, but I'm saying, of your generation, it's much harder to trace up those weddings because they were good weddings.
Yeah.
So, but that's how they often solve the problem today because people don't know, and then they go have another kid, and then you don't want to do that to a kid to make him a momser. They can only marry another momser, whereas that stigma forever. It's a terrible thing. So we want to be very careful with that. So getting gets is vital. Okay, any more questions on that? I guess we should really... what else did I want to say? I have on the bottom of my sheet, I just want to say Lech Lecha, because we have that Parsha coming up. So I just wanted to mention, in terms of what's a commandment and what's not, Lech Lecha is clearly a directive. Go to yourself, right?
Right.
So I just want to echo a thought that I noticed when I taught over the summer, just in terms of the two times in the Torah that it says Lech Lecha. There's only two times. And they're both to Abraham. So the first one is when he's told to leave his land and go to the land that I'll show you, right, in this next week's parsha. Lech lecha, go. And really, lech lecha means go to yourself. Lecha is to you, go into you. So you're going to have to physically leave where you're coming from in order to go into the destiny of your you-ness. That's what lech lecha means. But so that's his first. Abraham is considered to have 10 tests, and his first one is to have to leave his father's land, his birthplace, leave behind his past to go into his future. And the final test is the sacrificing of Isaac, which begins with the words Lech Lecha. Right? So it's interesting just to see how the 10 tests are bookended by the words Lech Lecha. So I looked it up just to see those. That's the only time in the whole Torah that the phrase Lech Lecha is used, is just by those two tests of Abraham. And so the first test is leave behind your past. And really the binding of Isaac is give up your future. Mm-hmm. Right? Like you thought, you're not the first monotheist on the planet, Abraham, but you're the first monotheist with a mission. You're the first monotheist that wants to pass this on. And you saw that it wasn't Yishmael who's going to take it, and it wasn't your student, Eliezer, who was going to take it, and it wasn't your nephew, Lot, who was going to take it forward. All of those, your progeny, were not the ones who were going to bring it forward. But now, clearly, Yitzhak is the guy. Proven by the fact that he's walking with you so nicely up the hill, right? And now what? Now you have to let go of him. You have to let go of your whole future.
So the past and the future.
So the past and the future, those are really his tests, is let go of whatever he was thinking about. What we were talking about earlier a little bit, right? Just let go of what you were thinking. It's not
this
about
reality,
that, right?
You've got to
be in
is.
The moment and live with Hashem and what he tells you right now. It's not about your plans, your hopes, your expectations, and what you were thinking makes sense to you. That's not it. Let go of that. And just walk with Hashem how he asks you to walk with him. That's it. So that's what Lech Lecha is about, is leave behind what you were planning. What you had in mind for your life. That's not it. You just got to move into what Hashem has in mind for your life and go do that.
Easy for Abraham to figure that out.
I think not. That's why there were tests. Yeah. And that's why his ultimate test was Yitzhak, is to leave that. Yeah. Not so easy. Easy for us to look at Abraham, who paved the way for us to be able to access
that quality.
We're looking back. He had to live through it. We can now look back. The same way we can look at Edison and say, how smart was he to be able to develop this, that, and the other, think of the light bulb. Yeah. It makes perfect sense once you've thought of it.
Yeah.
But thinking of it is really hard. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what Lech Lecha offers us, is the ability to leave behind our past and our future and be with Hashem the way Hashem wants us to be with Him. So with that...
We should all strive for that.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's difficult.
Yes. So that's where we'll end for today. And
Wednesday.
Nice. And Wednesday next week.
And you'll send an email out.
And I will send